I think for me, the biggest thing that I'd recommend is similar to what I mentioned earlier, is that resign yourself from the responsibility of worrying about if I'm going to get hurt or if there's going to be obstacles. It's a given. And your mindset has to be challenges and getting hurt is going to happen. What am I going to do about it? And how am I going to succeed despite it?
Hey everyone, welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm Jeremiah Garcia, your host from Guide Dogs of Hawaii. This is a safe space for blind and visually impaired individuals to come together, share experiences, and learn from each other. Today, we have someone with years of experience in basketball, and even though he's visually impaired, he's still been able to do multiple different sports. He's going to share with us the different types of struggles that came along with playing sports and a lot of enjoyable things that he was able to experience because of sports as well. What initially got you interested in playing basketball?
When I was growing up in Hawaii, my father got me interested in playing basketball because he would actually play with his coworkers after work. My dad was a two-job worker. He wasn't like most folks who have one job and go home. So in between jobs or on his days off, because he wanted to spend time with me, he would take me to those games and play with his friends from work. After that, though, I was really interested in the sport because it was something that most people in my family also enjoyed, not just only my father or on my dad's side. My uncle was also a player in the Philippines, and my auntie would used to tell me stories about how he would go to the local parks, the local courts, and they would bet on ice water or how he would get into fights after playing and she would have to bail him out, things like that. And it sounded really cool. Watching it on TV was also really great. So after that, that's when I was really hooked on basketball. That's really what got me into it in the first place.
So after your family got you into it, what do you think the most enjoyable part about playing was?
There's two things that I would say are the best parts. And the first one is just sort of the feeling that it gives you on the inside in terms of my heart is racing, my focus is very complete, and it's really easy to get distracted in everyday life. But playing sports, playing basketball really was one of those activities in my day where I was solely focused on that and I felt comfortable only thinking about that. Growing up in Hawaii and having parents who stressed education and doing extracurricular activities and being civically engaged, that means that every hour and minute of my life, I'm not just thinking about one thing. I'm thinking about the impacts that it has for my family, the impacts that it has for my community, and I'm also thinking about how I'm going to make it through the next day, the next hour, the next week. Playing basketball eliminates that stress, that worry that you always have in terms of growing up as like a child of an immigrant and things like that. Mm. And then the second thing for me that really is the best part of playing basketball for me was that it let me connect with people from my community, from Filipinos and other people in Hawaii, because it's a really big sport in the Philippines. There's a great documentary about it on YouTube where people will literally play in the streets. They will play with slippers on, even if they don't have shoes. It's a everyman sport kind of game. And that's what really got me involved with it, because I would meet everyone from different places in the Philippines.
Were there any safety concerns you had to deal with in this kind of practice?
Honestly, yes. I feel like most people, my parents, my family, my coaches, everyone was concerned for my safety, a little bit more so than myself. I feel like I was more cavalier about it. And really my attitude when playing basketball is almost like it's a do or die, especially because we have this saying in the Philippines that it goes like this. In English, it's a little hard to translate, but sort of like you're going to give up your life to win, right? Buwis buhay, right? You know, that's what you pay, right? The fee for success, the fee for even just playing the sport is your life. And for me, that meant even if there was risks, even if there were for sure times where I got hurt, I just took it as a given, right? I give it as a resignation of like, this is what I'm going to put out and whatever else happens doesn't matter. A lot of people were concerned. There's three main concerns. It's usually like trips and falls. The second one would probably be things like collisions, you know, bumping into people. And then the third would be just sort of miscellaneous stuff, like not seeing the ball coming, getting hit by the ball, stuff like that. And the first concern, I totally understand. I mean, even in everyday life, as visually impaired people, we have to worry about tripping and falling. And what kind of made me more comfortable, especially with basketball specifically, is you play on a flat surface, right? You can't play a game without, you know, there being uneven terrain and things like that. And feet do get tangled and stuff like that. But that's totally normal. Even sighted people have issues with that, running into people. And that brings me to the collisions and bumps kind of part of it, is that basketball is a contact sport. It's a physical game. And it really wasn't unusual to me, because when you talk about the brand of the sport, when you talk about the culture of the sport, the Philippines is known for having really physical basketball players. And a really good example is like Rene Del Del Campo. He's a famous basketball player who just retired. And for me, I grew up watching players like that. And I also grew up with grown men that I would play basketball with as a kid. I would play with grown men. And every time down the court was like a man-to-man play kind of situation. That made me more tough in that situation and made me more comfortable. And then the last one was in terms of just getting hit by the ball and stuff like that. That's a given. And that's part of what I was talking about kind of resigning my safety or my life. For me, it was just sort of like, it's going to happen. I just have to plan on like what I'm going to do, how I'm going to deal with it, as opposed to worrying about when it's going to happen or how it's going to happen. I already know it is. It's a given. We just have to work around it, right?
Yeah. Was there any sort of like equipment that you wanted or that you use just to prevent things? Like, I know you wouldn't want to wear glasses while playing basketball and risk of them breaking and stuff like that.
Yes, I definitely would think the top three for me would be goggles, prescription goggles specifically, because those are really expensive. The second would be things like knee protectors or the slides that have the extra padding in them. And the third would probably be like arm sleeves, because the one thing is that for trips and falls and stuff like that and contact, it's inevitable. At least those things will help keep your skin fairly protected. It's not mainly to, you know, protect your bone or your muscle, but it's mostly for your skin. You don't want to bleed, right? And most times in any kind of league, if you start bleeding, they'll stop the game to get somebody to check you out. And it makes things more of a hassle. It's more annoying. For the goggles, that one's more difficult, especially for visually impaired people, in my opinion. The reason why is that they typically tend to be more expensive, especially with the prescription. I remember being quoted in eighth grade, right before I was going to go into high school, and they were offering me to play. I was quoted at Lens Crafters that it was going to cost, it after all of the insurance benefits and things like that, I was quoted it was almost $300 for one pair. And growing up as a child of an immigrant, as people from a not so well-off background, what that means is that, you know, I was priced out of the resource that I need. And that's also for the other two as well. They seem like accessories that aren't really necessary. You know, they seem like something that's for flash. And even as a normal player of basketball, if you wear things like that, people will make fun of you. They'll say, oh, you know, you're trying to copy or be like the superstars on TV or something like that. You've been watching too much TV or playing too many games. But they do really help in terms of protecting your skin, making sure you don't bleed, you don't get scratched, or if you slide on the floor, your sweat doesn't go everywhere on the floor, which is a reality not only just for visually impaired players, but you know, for everyone. you take that resource away and it just makes things that much more difficult, right?
Even with the lack of resource that you had, was there ever any requirements that you needed in order to play that ever held you back or anything like that?
From the standpoint of like the bureaucracy of it, about the on paper requirements, no. For the most part, as long as you're okay with it and you can prove to the doctor or the athletic trainer, the athletic personnel, that you are able to participate, that you're comfortable, that even if you struggle or you know have a little bit of difficulty, that you'll still be game to figure it out and continue trying. I think that's the major part of it. I'd say, especially for us as disabled people or visually impaired people, a question that I got from my doctor, for example, was that they were surprised, they weren't really aware that I could meet the requirements in terms of like, oh, so you can catch the ball, you can see the basket, you know, you can see other players, right? That was the number one thing. And it just took some convincing. But I know that that may differ for a lot of people depending on how much vision you have and what other situations or circumstances that you might have when you go for your examination. For me, it was very easy because I could show them physically, I could show them videos, but I really think it should be a case-by-case basis as far as like what the requirements are, especially because in different locations and different people, they have their own interpretation of the rules. And I can't really speak to say what that might look like. Only I can speak to my experience. And that's really what I experienced in terms of like, well, okay, if you say so and they see it in person, then you know, okay, that makes sense in their brain.
So after you proved that you were able to play, what would an average day of practice be like after you got accepted into a high school or a club, etc.?
So for high school, typically a day of practice, it would look like, you know, right after school, we would go ahead and depends on what the focus of the particular practice was. If the focus was conditioning, if the focus was skills, or if the focus was game strategy. So if it was athletic conditioning day, it might either be doing a weight session or doing a session on the track. Honestly, weight sessions were really, really rare, in my opinion, sometimes. Conditioning with going to the track, that was probably the most common out of the two, because basketball is a running-oriented sport. You're constantly moving, right? You're not very stagnant for a long time. Days like that, we'd probably be at the track maybe hour and a half, doing combinations of long distance runs and short sprints put into combinations so that it makes us more ready to adapt to situations on the basketball court. So we'll do like 100 meters just to simulate trying to run back on defense. And then we'll do a 250 just so that we can simulate, oh, what happens if the ball gets turned over and then the other team turns the ball over again? You got to run back on offense, right? So those are the basic things that we would do. Of course, long distance runs are just for your overall endurance. So we would do like a mile, 2 miles, just to make sure that even if we are not doing anything that requires sprinting, we're still able to move consistently. Practices that oriented around skills, that would probably be, you'd start, you know, by stretching and warming up, and then you move to different stations on the court, and then they would do different skills. So they do passing, defense, shooting, and we would just do various drills in groups of 3 to 5, depending, because obviously the gym would also be occupied by different sports. So you know, things like the women's basketball team, for example, we'd have to split the court in half. So sometimes we would do 2 drills only because we only had 2 hoops, and we'd split it up into like 6 or 7, 5. And those practices usually lasted, they lasted longer, especially because those ones you're moving less, especially between drills and them explaining technique. So those would probably last greater than 2 hours for sure. And we'd probably get home at night around maybe as late as 8:30 or 9 o'clock, as from what I remember, because a lot of people, especially, we would have to wait for the gym. So sometimes we'd be at school until like 4 or 5 until we were able to use the gym. The last one would be plays and strategic kind of practice. And that one usually was the shortest, especially because it's very mentally taxing. You know, I have to think about all of it, and not only just the physical side of running through the plays or going through what it looks like or going through what it physically feels like to be in the correct position, right? Then there's the mental aspect of, okay, this is what the opponents are going to do. This is what their star player is. This is what their strategy is going to be, and this is how we're going to have to overcome that. There's a big mental side of that.
What do you think the most challenging part of all of the practice is?
The most challenging part for sure was knowing specifically how to do things, not necessarily how they worked. I can understand the mechanics, but the details were the hardest part. And the reason why is my coaches, you know, they were all able-bodied. Most of the players they ever worked with, if not all of them, were able-bodied people. And they didn't need to adapt the way that they coached for other people, because that's not their experience. So for me, having to get them to explain in detail, other than, you know, move here, move there, I want you to move from the baseline to the right elbow, and then I want you to flash, and then I want you to screen, right? Those very specific ways of describing what's happening, and not only just also explaining what it's supposed to feel like. You're setting a good screen if you can feel this. You're setting a good screen if you can delay the person for this long. You're setting a good screen if you're opening up to the ball instead of turning your back to the ball when the person's holding it. Those very minuscule details, that was the most difficult part of learning, because they had to – just trying for them was, I feel like, was very difficult, and they never really – wrap their brain around how they needed to explain things to me and to kind of pass that knowledge on. And that's why I mentioned earlier that I was largely self-taught, because there's very few people who understand not even just the way to explain things to somebody who's visually impaired or work with them. It's that they don't actually have the in-depth enough knowledge to be able to describe things in detail, because they themselves don't understand the full mechanics of how everything works. So when I'm playing for a coach, especially sometimes there's some coaches who don't play basketball, who never had an actual playing career, they don't understand what certain things are supposed to feel like, what part of the body is supposed to flex. They don't have that experience, and they can't tell you, okay, when you're shooting the ball, you want your tricep and your bicep engaged. When you're backing down someone, you actually don't want your weight to be in your butt. You want your weight to be on your back, right? Because they don't have that experience, they can't tell it to me in that detailed way that I need to know anyways. It just hampers the way that they want to try to run their program, and it kind of throws a wrench in everything.
So since you had to teach yourself a lot, how would you overcome that obstacle?
I think the number one thing is to have the right team and have the right ability to communicate. Okay, this is very difficult for you to understand, but I'm going to need you being the coach or your trainer, I'm going to need you to meet this set of requirements and really set that firm boundary. I feel like because they're your coach or they're your trainer, they're your authority figure, right? It makes you less able to speak up, I feel like, because in those situations, you don't want to disappoint them. You don't want to make them feel like you're bossing them around. But I think that's a number one issue too, is when you're looking for the right team or you're looking for the right group of people to support you when you are playing, they have to be able to understand that you're equals, right? Because the coach can't jump on the basketball court and start playing, right? So you're equal parts to make a wholesome game, right? Coaching is the one half where you're not playing. The players do the playing. So when you have a coach who's very authoritarian like that, who doesn't view you as an equal, right, it makes it very difficult. And I think that's another more thing that you need to focus on when you're trying to overcome these challenges with bad coaching, especially for a visually impaired person, because to start, if you're going to jump into a situation with a bad coach, it's not going to end well, right? Some people are more adaptive than others, but you can tell that about a person. If they start out like that, but they're very open to being communicated with and being open to setting the right boundaries, that's great. But some people are really not. And you can tell if you can just test the waters with really basic questions, really basic requests. If you're in that situation, I would say just don't proceed. Honestly, just don't proceed. If you're not comfortable and they're not comfortable with what your needs are, you have to move on and find somebody who's going to be the right fit. Because if you're just going to sit on their roster, you're going to sit under their tutelage and gain nothing. Honestly, that's number one, that's just not fun, which is what sports should be for, right? And number two, it doesn't contribute to your personal success or development, which is ultimately or should be someone's prime goal or objective. If you're not meeting your objective, you have to find a way to do so. And that's the easiest way. The second one would be, for sure, I know this is a big topic in disabled or visually impaired discourse, but for sure is standing up for yourself. Because I feel like a lot of people who are visually impaired, when they go into these situations, because this is also my personal experience, when these people are your positions of authority, you don't really want to speak up. You don't want to stick out like a sore thumb because, I don't know, they'll make you run suicides, or they'll call you out in front of the whole team, or something similar. And I totally get that. There is definitely a problem with coaches doing stuff like that. But it kind of leaves a anxiety or a mental roadblock that hurts not only just your performance, but your confidence. Because if you don't stand up for yourself, even if they don't change, it means that the issues that you're having are known, and it creates the opportunities to have more discussions and ultimately make the changes that you need the coaches or just the overall athletic system to make. Because if they don't know what the problem is, and unfortunately many able-bodied people don't, because they don't have that experience, well, they're going to learn today if you speak up for yourself. But if you don't, they'll never learn. And either you yourself in the future or somebody else who is in a similar position, they won't be able to get that help. So if you say something, something might get done. I can't lie and guarantee that something will get done if you say something, but it's better than not doing anything at all.
Even with a bunch of difficult things you have to deal with as someone who is visually impaired trying to get into this kind of sport, do you feel like there were any significant benefits in return, like your physical health, your mental health, your social life, things like that?
For sure. And as I mentioned earlier, it was a great way for me to meet people in my community. It was a great way for me to make friends. And for myself, it was also really good for me to be able to sort of have a place, like I mentioned earlier as well, to have an escape. And mentally, there's a lot of techniques for having good mental health, and balance is really important for creating those spaces where you don't have to worry about school, you don't have to worry about work. Obviously, that's when you're free when you're a little older. But even when I got older and I spent less time playing basketball, those hours and minutes were really important to me in the day. It gives you a sense of accomplishment that I feel like gives you more confidence as well, because I did this today. I made this many shots today. I did this many push-ups today. Those sort of mini confidence boosts, they add up. Even if you're having a bad day, you can tell yourself, oh, I did these things. Because I feel like a very common thing that, especially that I told myself when I was feeling unmotivated or not confident, is, oh, I didn't do anything at all today, or I'm not good at anything. But you can't really say that when the proof is in the pudding, when the physical evidence of the things that you're doing is present, right? So saying I didn't do anything at all today is false, right? I did X amount of push-ups. I did this many shots. I did this many layups, right? The other part of it too is that it gives your life a certain amount of consistency. It makes me and a lot of other people very anxious when, you know, we don't know what's coming next. What am I doing tomorrow? What kind of struggles will I have tomorrow or the next day or the next day? But I know internally that, okay, well, tomorrow I'm going to play basketball, right? Tomorrow I'm going to practice this. And no matter whatever happens that day, I have that consistent break from the world, honestly, was what it felt like. I have that consistent, oh, I'm going to do this tomorrow morning. And it gives you something to wake up for. You know, a lot of people who struggle, they say, you know, I don't know what to wake up for in the morning. I can't wake up in the morning. For me, one of the things that helped me the best to do that was basketball. Especially in high school, I had a lot of extracurriculars, a lot of responsibilities, and academic responsibilities. So in average, for the last 2 years of high school, I probably only slept maybe 5-6 hours a night. And that's like on a very good day. Most of the common sleep times, I would average probably like 3.5-4 hours. And when I got up in the morning, I just thought of, well, at least when I get to school later, I'll be able to play basketball for a little while before school starts.
If someone who is visually impaired wanted to start trying sports, would there be any advice you'd give them, regardless of their personality?
I think for me, the biggest thing that I'd recommend is similar to what I mentioned earlier, is that resign yourself from the responsibility of worrying about if I'm going to get hurt or if there's going to be obstacles. It's a given. And your mindset has to be, challenges and getting hurt is going to happen. What am I going to do about it? And how am I going to succeed despite it, right? How much do you want to succeed is a question that you need to ask yourself every day. And I know it sounds very cliche, but it's very true, because I feel like sports, and kind of it's sort of, I sort of really missed it on this earlier when you asked me what benefits, but being goal oriented is extremely important, because you just won't progress without being goal oriented. There's only so much that your raw talent can let you go with without having the resources or just doing the work. So asking yourself that every day is a really big part of becoming goal oriented, so that you can meet whatever your expectations or objectives are. And when I mentioned earlier about just sort of resigning your fate, it gives you one less thing to worry about, so that you can give more focus and concentrate more on more pressing issues or more pressing topics that you really need to cover in whatever sport you're doing. So instead of worrying about, oh, am I going to get hurt today? It's like, well, how am I going to win? How am I going to defend this person? How am I going to score? Right? Those are the more important pressing questions. And if you get that out of the way and you get that little bit of mental energy out of it and reassign it and reallocating your resources better, that's what will make you the most successful. And ultimately, that's kind of the biggest piece of advice I'd give. Most of the other things I'd say advice-wise would be, like I mentioned earlier, is finding the right team, being able to stand up for yourself, and to do it as consistently and as often as possible.
As we draw to a close with this episode, I want to thank you for joining me. I hope you enjoyed your visit and found useful information. We welcome your feedback at feedback@guidedogsofhawaii.org. It would be great if you would visit us on our social media platforms, such as Instagram and Facebook. You can find us by simply searching for Guide Dogs of Hawaii.